Welcome to Parallel Lines, and we have an esteemed guest today.
As previously trailed.
We have Roger Ford with us, who I've known since I was recording last night, Roger, the first time we met, though we'd been writing at the same time. And it was you that actually encouraged me to write for Modern Railways. You told me I shouldn't be dallying with all the enthusiast people anymore. So I'm very grateful permanently for that. But we met the first time at Old Dalby, if you remember, and they were launching the Adelantes and the Coradias, as they called the 175s at the time. And the thing that new manufacturers were terrified of was Roger getting on a train, and it was the fist of death. The first thing he'd do is walk down a train and thump it mercilessly, looking for a bit that was loose. And it was the first time I'd seen it in reality, was Roger jumping onto this brand new train that Ulster had knocked together in Birmingham in the dark and just walking through, hammering it. And that was my introduction to you, Roger. So welcome, and welcome to the fist of death.
Fist of quality.
Well, I thought it was a fist of death.
That was the day that I was just getting over a bout of bowel cancer. And we were going to buy a Ford car, but Mrs. Ford persuaded me to buy a Ford Puma, which was a pocket rocket. And Mr. Miles was terrified when I drove him back to the station.
You've actually jumped in the thing that I was going to say next. I'm in the company of two people who've made me grab seats, you see, because I'd never met you before. You said, hello, nice to meet you. Get in and I'll show you what it does. And this was that first thing. And we shot up down this country lane near Old Dalby with me literally clinging on while Roger's going, look at this, fantastic, isn't it fantastic? But Anna Jane took me to the station a few weeks ago after one of our recordings. And when she encounters bad driving, she becomes 300% more northeastern.
Why, man? What are you doing?
And I was,
Tony, that was a terrible impression of my accent. But he is right. I do get a slight bouts of road rage living here in Liverpool, where people are, not the best drivers. But Roger, lovely to meet you for the first time today for me. I don't have a long history of working with you. But I think we're going to get on fine, because I'm the daughter of a rolling stock engineer who loves to go on new trains and point out every little rattle, every little knock, every little bang on the new rolling stock. So, I feel like we're going to get on just fine.
So, before we get on to rolling stock, Roger, we've been talking in a previous episode about there's a new government and it has decided to fix things fast and sort the railways out, which, as you know, is something that can be done in a couple of weeks, obviously, because you've been there before and you've seen it. Always works. A couple of weeks, we'll sort it. So, from your perspective, because you've spoken to people who are going to be tasked with trying to pull things together and make them run differently, what do you see is happening at the moment? What do you understand is the grand plan?
Well, we have to start with where we are. And the rail we've got at the moment isn't suitable for restructuring, because 30 years ago, the John Major government broke the railway up into 100 pieces to sell off. And it's gradually come back together, but we've still got trains run by various different operators. We've still got the track, which is separate from the trains, and we've got various other parts. So the first thing to do is, when they say they're going to nationalise, that's not the word. They're going to restructure. They're going to reconstruct the railway. And that means putting track and trains back together. And that's not going to be easy. British Rail reorganised in the 1980s, going from a sort of a number of regions and businesses. And they turned it into a vertically integrated, that is, track and train business, where Intercity was responsible for its trains, its tracks, its stations, its engineering, its everything. And that took 10 years. And that was with the might of the BR machine behind it. It took 5 years to break the railway up, but it's going to take, I reckon, another 10 years to put it together. And this is why. What we're starting from at the moment is a track run by Network Rail. We've got the trains run by a mixture of private operators and some already under state control. And the hard part is going to bring back together the track and the trains. Everybody's worried that if Network Rail takes over, it'll be a bunch of engineers running the trains because they don't really care about customers. And the private sector worries that they'll be shut out. They will be shut out. So what you've got to do, first of all, is establish a business, a railway business, running trains, I think, and then gradually merge into it the tracks to create this vertically integrated railway. And that's not going to be easy. Although Louise Hay said she'd move fast and fix things, yes, you can move fast, but actual fixing is going to be bloody slow, to use a technical term. The situation is that, first of all, they're going to bring the private sector operators several of whom are state railways from Europe, but they call them private sector. As their contracts to run the trains at the moment expire, they're going to be brought back into an organisation which was the operator of last resort. It hasn't got a new name yet. It goes under the acronym of DOHL, Department of Transport Holdings Operator of Last Resort, but that's going to be the lead part. That's led by a man called Robin Gisby, and he's a very experienced railway man. He started in freight. He's run regions. He's run bits of Network Rail. He was chief operating director and so on. The present Railways Act says you have to have franchises. So there's a parliamentary act that is going through the House of Commons and the House of Lords at the moment, the aim of which is to get rid of the section of the old Railways Act, which says you've got to have franchises. And then as these contracts expire, they're going to bring them back under Mr. Gisby's organisation. So let's call that, that's the passenger rail business. What happens to Network Rail is difficult because that is run by a man called Andrew Haynes, and he is determined that Network Rail is going to be abolished because he thinks that it's not customer focused. So you've got this situation where you've got to pull the two together. Louise Hague, the Transport Secretary, has said in her earlier statement that she's told Mr. Haynes and Mr. Gisby to work together, and they will. But then you really need somebody to help pull it all together, which we come down to this further person called Alex Hines. Now, Mr. Hines has experience of running an integrated railway because in Scotland, Transport Scotland actually pulled track and trains together. And although they were separate as businesses, they actually ran as a business. And who should run it but Mr. Hines? Now, Mr. Hines has been called down south to the Department for Transport to take over the rail part of the Department for Transport. So he's the third person in this triumvirate. So you've got what sounds a bit like an old firm of solicitors, Haynes, Hines and Gisby, to actually pull together. So you've got these three of them working together, and I'm sure they can, with Mr. Hines pulling together, making sure that Mr. Haynes and Mr. Gisby work together to produce the integrated railway. So the first stage is going to be starting in the new year, as the contracts that the current private train operators have expire, or if they don't perform well and their contracts are cancelled, they go into DOHL, Mr. Gisby's business, and that will gradually expand. Now, a lot of people are still sort of in revenge for privatisation mode, and they want nationalisation, you know, get rid of the evil capitalists with their top hats and swigging champagne. But really, it's not about nationalisation, renationalisation. That's the wrong word. It's reconstruction. So what they really want is not just failed. At the moment, DOHL is failed businesses that were brought into Mr. Gisby's empire. What we really want to do is bring some of the really successful ones into that as well to start setting up a proper integrated passenger business. And that's what we're going to see over the next couple of years. They'll be bringing in businesses, Great Western, Greater Anglia. Greater Anglia would be a very good one to bring in because that is a very successful franchise. It's actually making money on top of it. They've already got Southeastern, which is another successful one. And what Southeastern is doing is having what's called an alliance. This is where Network Rail and the train operator work together with a common management, common aims. We've had an alliance before, which was encouraged by, of all people, Mr. Gisby, and that was Southwest Trains. And Southwest Trains showed that if you have an alliance with a common management team, it can work well. For example, under the contractual arrangement of a normal franchise and Network Rail, if you want to shut the line for the weekend to replace the track, you have to pay compensation. But what you can do in an alliance is say, well, look, it's better for the business as a whole if we put this new track in. So they just do it, and you don't involve contracts and everything. So we've got a lot of experience here coming together. So what I see is over the next 2 to 3 years, they're going to be bringing the passenger businesses into Mr. Gisby's operation, and they're going to be gradually setting up alliances. And what I think that will eventually emerge will be passenger businesses which have responsibility for both the trains and the track, and Network Rail will disappear. But that's going to take a long time, I think, and based on my guess, it's going to be 10 years.
And the government has decided that it will still keep some private involvement, both on the freight side and on what's been termed the open access operators, the operators that don't have a contract to run services. So mixed in with all of this taking back control, as we suggested might be the phrase, there will still be private businesses as well, which have contracts for things.
We can look at that in two ways. Freight will have to have, I think there will have to be, when you have this great British Railways, or the new, whatever they call the new company, it's going to have a director of freight who's incentivized to actually grow freight business if possible, and that's it. So that's it. So freight will have contracts. It will have a director on the main railway board looking after it, and I think that's easy. The open access operators, the swashbuckling pirates, you know, putting in services, etc. Recently, we got hold of a timetable that Mr. Haynes, you see, it's all these people, it's all the same people. And Mr. Haynes was asked by the government to produce a new timetable for the East Coast Main Line aimed at maximising capacity. So he sat down and it was what was called a neutral mind blank sheet of paper timetable, which didn't care about operators. And what he's done there is he's produced paths, slots in the timetable for the main operators like LNER and Great Northern and so on. But he's also left what are called common paths, and these will be available to open access operators. Now, up to now, open access operators have had to be very clever and try and find slots for their trains, which mean they may leave the station. One train may leave at 9:05, the next one leaves at 10:40, the next one leaves at 3:15. But these common paths would give them an hourly path, which they could share, if necessary, throughout the day. So I think what will happen with the open access operators is, and this is why, of course, and this is another reason why they've got this clause about getting rid of franchises, the open access operators will be told, here's a slot, an hourly slot or twice an hourly slot if you don't want to use it all the time, and you can use it for your purposes. Open access has made timetabling difficult and inefficient. For instance, on the East Coast Main Line, where capacity is a problem, you've got LNER running 9-car or 10-car trains, but the open access operators run 5-car trains, equally for freight. So you've got a 5-car train carrying perhaps, 200 people, occupying a slot that could be occupied by a 10-car train or 2,000-ton freight train. They are going to have to bite the bullet and be told, well, this is what you can have. It'll be better than what they have at the moment, but whether they'll be able to afford it is up to them to decide. So open access operators, not a problem. They'll be catered for, but it won't be a free-for-all anymore.
Can I just go back to something you said earlier on, Roger, which was fascinating, about you described how the new model is going to work in a way that sounded like you set up the operations side, the what is now the TOCs, they come in-house, and then Network Rail essentially becomes part of them. The track goes into the operations side was kind of how you described it. I find that fascinating. That's not how I've understood it so far. It's been quite the other way around. And the fear is, for many people, it is a fear, is that everything becomes Network Rail rather than how you've described it.
Well, that was the general theory of the William Shapps report. You remember Mr. Shapps, my MP, who's no longer my MP. He was also a transport minister. Gave the impression that you would have the Network Rail regions, which would then subcontract train services, like franchising. And that's where we went. But if you go back to Bob Reid's modernisation of the railway in the 1980s, his aim was to actually create what he called the business-led railway. Now, where's the business? Who earns the money? The train operating companies. Mm. Who spends the money? Network Rail. So you can't really have the person who spends the money with the person who actually generates it as a customer. It's got to be the other way around. And I've come around this way of thinking that what you have is you do what Bob Reid did. He had sectorisation. So he started off with these sectors, intercity, regional, Network Southeast, and then gradually built them up. And they started off just running trains with the BR Reid, British Rail Regions, who had the tracks in, you know, doing the work, and gradually brought them in. And at the end, blended it in gradually. And at the end, you had intercity, which was responsible for its trains, its tracks, its engineers, its servicing, everything like that. And I think it's not going to be easy. There are all sorts of reasons why it might not work, but you can't do it any other way. You can't have Network Rail regions running passenger services. Passenger services have got to be responsible for their track, trains, the lot.
And do you think that, I mean, you mentioned Andrew Haynes, but there's obviously a lot more players involved than just Andrew, despite what we might sometimes be led to think. Do you think others share that view? Do you think people get it, that sectorisation essentially is the way to achieve the end goal?
people aren't really thinking about this at the moment. I don't think they're so busy trying to run the railway, recover from the pandemic badgered by DfT about what they're spending or not spending. And I think that once they announce this shadow Great British Railways, it's real. There is a shadow Great British Railways, and there are people actually nominally in charge of it. And all three of them, I think, are not exactly averse to banging heads together, are they? It will start to happen. But I think the other point is, and the point Robin Gisby makes, is that we're all in this together, that going back over old scores of privatisation so won't work. And there are people out there in the private sector who could have a larger and more rewarding job within Great British Railways. We could all name one or two of them. But there's not a huge pool of managerial talent, and it's going to be spread pretty thin. So we've got to make the most of what we've got.
That was what I was going to ask. We've played this game over the years, the sort of who runs the railways thing, and you and I have chatted on the phone. Who do you think's the next up-and-coming generation of top managers and so on? The important thing for continuity is that those people who do know what they're doing are not so disturbed by the chaos that could ensue that they say, well, our pension is maxed, might as well go now, because we need their minds. And at the same time, they need to be mentoring the next generation of clever, didn't you call them brains on sticks once in the olden days? But the next generation of top people who can work together collaboratively and understand how it all works is crucial.
Well, the trouble is that privatisation only worked because of the people who had been in the British Rail management graduate trainee schemes and management schemes from about 1960s onwards, you know, Chris Green, Gordon Pettit, John Prideaux, and all those people. Who Runs the Railway, which I started about 1996, and I started colour-coding people, and I colour-coded XBR people deep blue, and the table became known as a sea of blue. And the last one I did, which was about 2015, was still people blue, you know, railwaymen, either deep blue XBR or people who've been trained since. But we've lost a generation of people with how to run a track and train railway. We've got quite a lot of people who can run a region, quite a few people who can actually run, not so many people who can run a train business, but the people with experience of everything, people who can sit down on a train with a piece of paper and do a quick timetable or whatever. And we've got to make the most, you know, you've got to be able to mentor people. As Tony says, you've got to bring people on. And we've got some new stars emerging.
Do you think there's enough new stars?
Have bigger jobs.
Have we got enough new stars?
Well, possibly not. We're going to make the oldsters can't go. They're going to have to nail them down at their desks. But of course, you can't run a railway from a desk, and all the best railwaymen go out and make sure what's happening.
Yeah.
On this patch.
So let's move it on a step, because the other thing that people are complaining about constantly are their trains. They don't like their trains, or they're not big enough, or they're not long enough, or they don't come regularly enough because the companies haven't got enough of them. So there are two things that you've been watching over the years. One is, during privatisation, the government very tightly specified how many trains people could own. And what a lot of people didn't understand was, if a company wanted to buy some more or buy some new ones, it had to get government permission. The private people in control was very much a myth, wasn't it? They couldn't say, we fancy some extra trains, we'll just go and get them. And a lot of people don't know how much a train costs. So tell me what a new train would cost me, and why is it that they had to get government permission to do that?
Well, you remember, Tony, that I came up with the idea of boiling frogs, which was the fact that I did some sums in about 2002 of comparing costs of infrastructure projects, of resignalling, modernisations, etc., compared with British Rail. And it turned out that they were three times per cost per mile of a British Rail scheme. And I thought nobody seemed to worried about this, and that was the boiling frog one, whereas if you put a frog in a bucket of cold water and stick a Bunsen burner under it, it won't jump out because it doesn't notice the rising temperature. And Mr. Miles carefully went down to the children's play shop, bought three frogs, put one of them in a beaker on top of a Bunsen burner, and boiling frogs is now industry shorthand for out-of-control costs.
You never tried it, did you?
No, it was a model from the Early Learning Centre, but I still have a frog.
I thought you actually did it.
No. We covered it in Vaseline to make it look real. Anyway, sorry, Roger.
But I'm a traction and rollstock engineer by experience in the past, and I'm proud to say that boiling frogs haven't affected the price of trains until recently. If you look at the last of the BR trains, the relatively modern British Rail trains, and you price them at modern money, a plain electric multiple unit vehicle has cost about £2 million. And it's been pretty constant since 1993-94, whereas infrastructure costs about by a factor of three or so, signalling everything. Trains, I'm proud to say, have not gone up in cost. So until the pandemic, a modern train cost about £2 million a vehicle. But then, of course, there's no such thing now as a standard train. Everybody wants batteries or hydrogen or whatever, level boarding and so on. And the price of a new train now looks as though it's about 2.5 for an electric multiple unit vehicle, or about 3 million for a diesel train, diesel hybrid train. So it costs. So even, you know, if you think of a typical 5-car electric train, 6-car, that's sort of 10, 12 million.
Can I just make a really possibly cheap point here, but I'm going to make it anyway because it's so obvious. Infrastructure cost has gone up threefold in what has been a publicly run part of the industry for the past number of years, but rolling stock hasn't gone up in the most commercially, what we know to be the most, or what we understand and talk about to be the most commercially driven privatised sector of the industry. Why do we think nationally operated railways are such a good idea for saving money?
Because the equipment cost has not gone up. It's the bureaucracy and the gold plating, etc., etc.
Doesn't that make it worse?
The trains, it's like saying, why hasn't the price of a Boeing 737 gone up or whatever? Because these sort of prices stay the same. Trains cost what they cost, and the amount you muck that price up by specifying is hard. Whereas if you look at signalling costs have gone up, whereas Siemens are perfectly capable of producing signalling a lot cheaper, but it requires discipline by the customer. And if the customer says, oh, I'd like those bells, or could I have those whistles, or I'd rather like that tutti frutti on top of the ice cream, the price goes up.
I totally understand that, Roger. My point is that the national operator of the infrastructure has been allowed to ask for the tutti fruttis for decades. So what assurances do we have that making more of the industry subject to that supposed, I don't know, freedom or whatever you might want to call it, we won't end up with inflated costs, not decreased costs, which is what we all want to need?
That comes down to discipline. British Rail costs. I got into awful trouble with top people in Network Rail when I compared the cost of the East Coast Main Line electrification under British Rail, which is delivered on time and to budget, with the Great Western electrification, which was about three or four times. It comes down to people, lack of experience, and someone actually saying, no, you can't have that. When they electrified in Wales, Siemens had a project director at Network Rail who was very on their side and disciplined and didn't ask for silly things. It comes down to people. It's not the structure. It's the people doing it. And I'm at the moment about to have a go at safety. People think, well, yeah, money's no object. We've got to be safer. And whereas, of course, money is an object. And it is with the case of Network Rail, it also goes back to privatisation. When the first managing director of Railtrack, as it was in those days before it went bust, didn't like engineers and he didn't like operators. And engineering and operating are the two big problems that we've got at the moment. And engineering and operating are the two pillars of the reliable railway. So it's not the ownership that counts, it's the structure and the people within it. And we've got a generation of people who sort of don't really think of price. Equipment costs, like signalling, you know, you can do signalling cheap quite effectively. The manufacturers know how to do it. It's the customer who won't buy cheap.
And the problem has been, I think, and we won't mention any names, but there have been people advising the government about expenditure on projects that have kind of encouraged the government to endorse the bells, the whistles, the tutti frutti on top. So the electrification of the Great Western Main Line was done. I think, you know, somebody said if there's a nuclear bomb goes off, everything will be demolished except the Great Western electrification. That will stand that. And purchase of trains at ridiculously, ludicrously high contract prices, which we've also covered. Certain people were involved in saying to the government, that's the way you should go a lot. And they weren't necessarily calling other people in to say, well, we could do it for half the price, actually. So do you think it's, you know, the wrong people have been allowed to have too much sway, too much control?
And there weren't the right people. It had all been got rid of under Railtrack. And if you think that the people who did the Great Western Electrification were in their 40s. You know, they were going to produce the best, et cetera, et cetera. And when it all went pear-shaped, who did they have to call in but Don Heath, 70-odd, who was the man responsible for the East Coast? And it had to call in the old people, similarly with signalling. Really experienced signal engineers who could do for five bob what anybody could do for any idiot could do for a quid. They went. There was a huge gap of experience and knowledge, and we're still trying to get it back.
So that could be the danger in trying to fix everything too quickly, that the people who we need to keep, it's come back around to that question again. We've got to make sure we don't lose the next generation as well, haven't we?
Which brings in another famous thing, which is a single profit and loss account. At the moment, you've got the passenger business run by DfT, which has its own profit and loss and subsidy. You have Network Rail, which is another part of DfT that has its own accounts. But what we want is a common set of accounts, which will show you where the costs are. I had a stab at doing that. And what that revealed was that Network Rail's debt, which it inherited from the private sector, is costing about $4 billion a year in debt repayments. Well, think what electrification you could buy for $4 billion a year. Mm. And when you've got track and train together with a common set of accounts, the managing director, the top of the passenger business or the top of the integrated business is going to say, hang on a minute, your infrastructure is costing us this, 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 and we're only earning that, that, that. And it'll probably give you a firmer hand on saying, look, do you really need that extra set of points there? Do you really need this and so on?
I think the common P&L, to go back to a previous point you made, is so crucial because alliancing, which you mentioned, you know, where it's failed in the past, and even if I was being slightly kinder than to say it's completely failed, where it hasn't succeeded as well as it could have done, and alliances I've been involved in, it's because there's the lack of the common P&L, and you get to a point where everybody can hold hands and sing kumbaya as much as you like and work in an alliance. But if you don't have the ability to make decisions based on, well, what about if we move the money around differently? What if we look at what it's actually costing us on the ledger? Well, it doesn't mean anything. You have to be able to say, let's save money over here and spend it over here in a different way, or else you're limited in how much that alliance means. Do you get what I mean?
And of course, on the Southwest Railway Alliance, the problem there was it was working, but then Network Rail was reclassified in 2013 and became part of the government. And immediately it was unbalanced. You had Stagecoach, who had shareholders to satisfy and profit and loss, whereas you had Network Rail Southern Region, which was a government subsidized thing. And it was like the chicken and the pig going in for produced bacon and eggs, you know, the pig was committed. But I think alliances with a common P&L, and the Great British Railways Transition Team, which I've given a lot of flack to, has done a brilliant piece of work on joint P&Ls. And I think that the alliances is going to be one of the steps towards getting to an integrated railway. But I think another point that we mustn't overlook in all of this is that you can't be distracted. And there's another election in 5 years' time, and the railway by then has got to make itself change-proof, I think. You know, we've got to go flat out for revenue, flat out for efficiency and so on. I don't think the reconstruction will be finished by then, but I think it's got to be in a situation where nobody can really make mucking up the railways, as it were, part of their manifesto. You know, if subsidies come down, ridership and revenue is coming up, it needs to be politician proof as well. You can't really make anything politician proof, but it needs to be as politician proof as you can make it.
So we need to move some of those dials far enough that people get that it's going in the right direction, even if we haven't reached the end of the journey yet. They need to see that's right.
If we can get back to my mantra of the boringly reliable, dependable railway, if revenue is coming back, if people are not complaining about cancellations or this, that and the other, if it's relatively stable, I think that's what we can hope for in 5 years' time. But while reorganising at the same time, so we've got to be very careful to keep everybody on side. You know, back in 1990-something, when the recession struck, British Rail had been going like really well until then. And then in 1989, there was a strike. And quite a bitter one. It was resolved. But Chris Green said that when they came back and he took over Intercity in the depths of this recession, he said we'd lost the workforce. And I think we've pretty well lost the workforce at the moment. Mm. And you're going to have to sort of have a period of, well, it's going to be about a year, I think, before we get a disruption-free railway with everybody working away and the business recovering. Because revenue, which is what it's all about really, has been stagnant for the last 12 months. It hasn't gone up. Ridership's come back, but revenue has been stagnant. And unless we can get revenue rising again, we're stuck.
So let's just go sideways on some of those things that you talked about earlier. You mentioned about buying trains, and you quoted the cheapest trains will be a straight electric train. And you wrote about all these fanciful ideas as to how we'd make the trains go along that just avoided the obvious solution of electrifying the railways. And you coined the phrase bionic duckweed as this sort of imaginary substance that would make trains run infinitely for an infinitely cheap fuel or whatever. We're still at the point, really, aren't we, that if we wanted a railway that was cheaper to run and would run most reliably and efficiently, and you've said we need to get it run reliably, boring, stable, lots of just ordinary electric trains would be quite a good thing. Do you remember when we used to get that first data in the days when we were doing rail business intelligence, and those old Mark 1 trains, and they were doing hundreds of thousands of miles without breaking down, and they were all
so drawn. Simple with non-electronic kit. And in fact, the latest trains, there have been two lots of trains since privatisation, but the first ones bought almost immediately afterwards privatisation, the Pendolinos, the Voyagers, to Zeros and so on. And then there was a second burst around about after 2013. And these latest ones are not as reliable as the older ones.
So looking at trying to make the railways boringly easy and cheap to run may involve some actual commitment to do stuff with the infrastructure, like electrifying the railways, rather than maybe, do you think, spending decades experimenting with alternative fuels or so on that still might not make a more reliable train? You've had this discussion over the years. You remember, how long ago was it that the chairman of GNER said, why don't we de-electrify the railways?
That's right.
But it's this cyclic thing again. But maybe are we at the point where we just need to, instead of trying to think of bionic duckweed solutions, we just say let's just create a modern electric railway, and then we can buy lots of cheap trains that would run reliably.
The trouble is that so much electrification came in, was authorised by Andrew Adonis, Great Western. I remember you telling me about the Northern work where they wanted to run over Chat Moss, and Network Rail hadn't done any work look at electrification. There was this huge burst of electrification, but the industry couldn't handle it, costs overran. And the Treasury doesn't trust us to do electrification anymore. That's the big problem. We then thought that decarbonisation would justify electrification, but of course it doesn't. And you're quite right. You know, an electric railway is a better railway, however you define better. And decarbonisation is one of the betters. A lot of people are saying, oh, well, let's decarbonise, let's get rid of DMUs. But, you know, there's such a lot of electrification to do before we get around to branches run by DMUs. There's a program of work of infills for freight that would have something like 80% of freight trains electrically hauled. And they're only small schemes, some of them only 2 or 3 miles. Mm. I think the longest is about 30. But getting electrification back on the agenda is very difficult, because Network Rail at the moment, well, nobody can work out how to do it at a cheap enough price. And that goes back to what we were talking about, the How do you specify a good enough electric railway rather than the perfection? Well, the Midland Main Line is going along. But even there, having done quite a good job getting to Market Harbour, they had a market building exercise. This is what we'd like to do. Instead of saying, well, come on, you've done a good job here, SPL, give us a price to do onward to Leicester and so on. And once again, that's something that an integrated railway might say, well, look, get a really decent price and let's get on with it. We've got to get electrification rolling and prove that we can do it at a low enough price not to frighten the Treasury, because the Treasury will stick 60% optimism bias on it anyway.
So that's infrastructure. And infrastructure is that thing, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, that somebody said, you know, for politicians, there's no ribbon cutting for just refettling a railway. They don't get to grandstand and say, this track has been reballasted over the weekend and I now cut the ribbon and so on. So there's no great political gain in it, which is also...
And no Ivy's jacket.
Yes, yeah. They can't put their hat on and look, you know. But the infrastructure is critical to all this as well, isn't it? Because good infrastructure, it doesn't damage trains. It doesn't slow the trains down. You know, when we also used to do the data, didn't we, of, you know, how reliable the railway was every month. And we kept pointing out, all the companies are saying, 70% of the delays, roughly, are down to the infrastructure not being very good in some way. So we have to convince the politicians that whilst there's no glory, there's no ribbon cutting in fettling up the railway. It's vital because that is one of the things that the public wants. They want the trains to run on time, boringly, reliably, and have a nice journey. And, you know, you and I, well, you used to balance coins on tables to prove how beautiful the ride was and so on, and made me try to photograph them and so on. So, you know, we'd love to have that railway back, the billiard table, Great Western Railway and stuff. That's all key to trains being reliable and not breaking down as well, isn't it?
But there's an even bigger problem here, of course, in the rural climate change and the resilience. You get embankments are sliding all over the place because they were built 150 years ago. You've got trees falling down. You've got all sorts of things. So there's extra costs being faced to cope with that while at the same time trying to improve the railway. It's not an easy time to be reorganising, preparing for the future and putting in enhancements like electrification. It's a difficult industry to be in. There was a marvellous run when we went from London to Edinburgh in 3 hours, 29 minutes in the IC225, and they'd fettled the track beforehand, and it was designed for 140 miles an hour, and at 140 miles an hour, the ride was brilliant. Nowadays, you sit in your Zoomer and you think, the seat's a bit hard and the ride's a bit lively.
Hmm. So we're in that sort of we've used lots of time stuff, and there's about 100 more questions we could ask, and you're probably going to have to come back again. But you have in your time been invited to sit and talk to the Transport Select Committee. You've been in those hallowed Select Committee rooms and quizzed. If you were invited in by the Transport Select Committee now and they said, Mr. Ford, after your many years of observing the railways and writing about them, what is your sort of three things that you think we need to do to deliver our promise to the public that they're going to have a better railway?
Restructure and get a boringly reliable, dependable railway running. Two, electrify. So get electrification going again. And three, try and make the railway exciting and attract people. We've got to get people wanting to ride. They won't leave their cars, you know, unless you give them a really good offer. And you can offer convenience, speed, etc., etc. But so I think those are the three things. Get an integrated railway which is boringly reliable and dependable. The electrification is vital to produce a better railway. But then I think we need to generate a buzz. We need to get something going again. You and I can remember the excitement of sort of record runs and launches. Remember the launch of the Pendolino? When did we last have a record run?
And is that where you think the people will get sorted then, Roger? Because so much of what you've said earlier on in this conversation is about, oh, you know, we've got the wrong people, we've lost all this experience and knowledge, and, you know, that's really what's wrong with the railway. So I'm just really interested, as someone who, you know, was a Network Rail graduate, and then I worked on the other side in the talks, and then I worked for Network Rail again, and they still let me go, and I work in a consultancy now. I'm just genuinely really interested in how do you get these Chris Greens and whoever else you've mentioned to exist again, because it feels to me like they don't want people who know about the railway and challenge what's going on. They particularly Network Rail, they like people who nod along, keep their head down and don't cause a bother.
That is an excellent point. You need to give people the ability. Robin Gisby says that one of the problems with the talks he took over, like Northern TPS, etc., is people say, can we do that? Or can we do this? You know, and he says, go out and do it, you know, fares, offers and so on and so forth. And I remember that Chris Green came to notice was he went out and did things. He was Freightliner's liaison officer with the British Railways Board. And there was a problem with a train leaving Hendon or somewhere late, Wembley. And the next thing happened was the staff at Wembley box had Chris Green coming into the box at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. A boss in the box at midnight. And he said, you do realise how important this is. This is chaps. And as I said, that's one of the things with record runs. You and I know, Tony, that when they do something spectacular, it lifts all the staff, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It brings everybody in. And you certainly need the people who are independent and will do stuff. You know, I got Chris Green a bollocking because I was up in Scotland when I was doing advertising, copywriting, as well as other stuff. And we were driving along and advertising agency manager. And I suddenly saw this signpost at the top of an embankment in Scotland. I said, can you stop here, Les? I just want to go up there. And he So I ran up, and it was Chris Green had introduced differential speed restrictions for HSTs. And by letting them run at 125, he could actually use an HST that came in to Edinburgh to go somewhere and come back. Anyway, so I published a picture of this differential speed restriction. The next thing I knew was Chris saying he got me into trouble. He hadn't told the British Railways board what he had done. He was running ScotRail. Red lampposts. You need people.
This would never happen now. I mean, this would never happen now. And I just wonder how much.
Well, how do we make it happen?
I'd love to find a way, but I wonder, and I don't want to sound like I'm saying it can't happen. I dearly hope that a lot of what you're describing could come to pass. But I wonder how much the world has changed as well as the people. And that, you know, we are, for instance, as a. Not just a railway, but generally, you know, as a country, as a world, I think. We're more risk averse, we're more litigious, you know, people are more concerned about health and safety, about losing their job, etc. I think in a different way, everybody was always bothered about losing their job, of course they were, but being on the hook for things now, I think people, I sense they are, you know, more cautious and about that in the world, and I wonder if you can ever get that back.
This is an editorial I'm writing in mentally at the moment, you know. Why is it that we don't do things properly anymore? Why is it the trains stop at slow to the ramp at 10 miles an hour and then dawdle along the platform to the stop rather than coming on in one smooth braking curve? And someone has to kick back against this. I've been talking to a couple of very senior railway people who both say that some of the safety issues, which are money and object, are actually holding back the operation of a reliable railway.
Mm. I mean, I'll give you another example, which you might find interesting, Roger. So I do quite a lot of work with Network Rail's graduate trainees. As I mentioned, I used to be one and now train them on operations. And one of the big differences that we've found is that the former generation, even really before my generation, I moved around a bit, but some of my colleagues who were BR grads, you know, they moved around because they were told, you know, you're going to manage the freight yard at Scunthorpe or whatever. That's your next job. You're going to be the station manager or the station supervisor at some backer beyond station, etc. And they went because, you know, they wanted to get on and that's what they did. You don't do that with people now. People don't move around. And they certainly don't. You cannot tell them to move around. In fact, you struggle to get them to... you struggle to get them in the office now, frankly, post-COVID, because a lot of the current generation of young people, and I'm not trying to tar everyone, I'm sure there are some people who are, you know, genuinely out there being enthusiastic, but there's a sizable majority who want to work a 9-to-5, want to work in a sterile office environment, you know, don't want to have to go and do shifts and dirty work out in the likes of a freight yard. And you can't tell them to, because the HR police will tell you, you can't do that. You have to advertise every job. You have to, you know, encourage everyone's development gently and all this kind of stuff. You can't say to a young manager, you are going to go and do that job next because I'm your boss and I'm telling you to. That doesn't exist anymore in the world. So that's certainly something we've lost.
That's worrying. Because the railway is a 24/7 business.
Yeah.
And drivers, and if the management, you know, the drivers, they used to refer to one shift as a birth control shift, wasn't it? That was 10 till 7 or something. They probably couldn't say that now, but drivers, you know, the railway's running, so if the management isn't in that mode,
yeah,
that's, you know, how can you run a railway?
And you'll know from the chats we get with the wise old hands, they will tell you the story of, it was 2 o'clock on a Sunday morning and we realised we'd got 300 people who were stranded, so we found a train and we sorted it and we phoned someone and said, will you come and drive a train because we've got to get it somewhere. And they grew up on those moments of, you wouldn't call them excitement,
it's the role models in the culture you grow up in.
Yeah, and they were proud of that and they still talk about that fondly. The wise hands that we know that are still there, that their eyes light up when they talk about the day they fixed things. We looked out of our office window and there were 1,000 people without a train, so we found a train and we found a driver and we got them home. And that passion certainly needs to be rediscovered in some way, I think, because that's the thing, when you find that they're sitting on a Sunday evening at home, supposedly their day off, but they're still thinking about the week's railway.
When they had the big King's Cross overrun. You remember the big King's Cross overrun?
After the Christmas, yeah.
With chaos at Finsbury Park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The VR director who went to Finsbury Park, Mr. Gisby, hived is on. You know, you've got to go in there and get stuck in.
Yeah.
But the people you describe aren't going to do that, are they?
No, but I suppose what I was trying to draw out there is that I feel like it's a little bit harsh to put it all on the people. I think the processes and the world around has changed. So the HR example is a good one. It's not necessarily the individual's fault. In fact, there might be lots of leaders who would like to tap people on the shoulder and say, you need to go and manage that freight yard. That's your next move. You know, you need to do that. And they're not allowed to, because we have to do things differently now. We have to advertise every job. We have to, you know, encourage everyone to apply. We have to interview everybody in a way that means you are limited in moving the chess pieces around. I genuinely feel this is a fact that in I'm going to sound very disrespectful now and say in the olden days, but you know, there was a time when you could do that. You could say it to somebody, I want you as my next number two, or I want you as this, that and the other.
People of the green Prilla generation moved all over the place,
and you can't do that now, because you know you just can't. And
they do it in the forces, don't they?
that's quite a big step for the realm.
We're not forces, are we? You know, and I just wonder where the line is between having to accept that and do it differently versus almost we're in danger of romanticising and pining over a time that has just gone, you know, and maybe we can't recreate these people in exactly the same way that we had them. We find a different way.
But there are the people who can do things, the David Horns, you know, can do things and so on. Alex Hines is not that young. It could be something to think about there.
Good, I'm glad I have. And I'll leave you something else to think about.
I always look to get something from these.
And I'll leave you with some other little nugget off the back of it, and then I promise we'll move on, which is I think what will be really interesting is to see, so going back again to what you mentioned with the lawyers of Hines, Haynes and Gisby, they are but three men, and who else is going to run this show? There will be some big jobs coming up that are new jobs that, you know, are incorporating both infrastructure and operations in the way you've described. This is going to be fascinating to see who gets those jobs. Where do they go, and to what extent is it, you know, the old guard? Do we go for something new? Do we go for a mixture? Do they try and divvy them up amongst the old Network Rail and the old operators? I think that's going to be interesting.
We've got to bring the young. Well, for instance, I reckon that you're going to have a powerful director freight at GBR board. I suggested Maggie Simpson. You know.
Yeah. Maggie's great. Yeah.
Across her.
Yeah.
And we've got to bring people in. Well, you know, what about Martin at Lumo? He's running two or three little firms. He ought to run something big because he's got a very strong personality and makes things happen. We've got to bring everybody together is the slogan. And that means, you know, you don't want to say to the private sector groups, go away, we don't want you. You're going to say, we want your best talent.
Yeah.
Should we just throw the two questions that we like to throw at people at the end, which are lighter finishing questions? This is like the question time thing.
We've got three for Roger because he's railway.
Oh, we've got three for you. So you can ask.
Oh, you've got three. You're right.
You've got the three questions then.
So the first question we ask our guest, Roger, is what is your favourite railway journey? And it can be anywhere in the world for any reason.
Up the East Coast Main Line on a morning. Sunny morning with the sun rising over the fens, having a great British breakfast.
Wonderful answer. Love that. I love the north end of the East Coast Main Line. It probably won't surprise you to learn the bit north of north of Alamo.
I had an interesting experience. You mean down past Holy Island?
Yeah.
I had an interesting experience in my youth. I was coming down, I was riding a mechanic on a loco, and the loco had a small toilet in the nose. And I was in there with the small toilet in the nose. We were hammering down past Holy Island in thick fog with the AWS squawking and beeping. And I thought, what an interesting way to meet your maker if we hit something.
Which we're very pleased you didn't.
Question two
is, what is your favourite railway station? And again, it could be anywhere in the world for any reason.
Venice.
Oh, we've not had Venice yet.
every time. You crawl into Venice on the train over the lagoon over the pillars, and you go into the Venice station, and then you go out of the door, and there's a Grand Canal, and woof, you're in Venice. Absolutely magic.
Beautiful. And finally, because you are railway, and we only ask, to be fair to people, we only ask this if they are railway, what has been your favourite job involving railways?
Writing about it.
Oh, lovely. So you're still there then? You're in your favourite job now then?
Yes, yeah. My second favourite job is looking after trains at Finsbury Park, but my favourite job is writing about them.
Oh, lovely.
Well, it's fascinating.
It certainly is, and I love reading your work, and we're so privileged to have had you on the show. Thank you for giving us some of your time. It's been
indeed
exceptional.
And every year Roger's Christmas card says something like, you know, here's to another interesting year, or I bet we can't top last year, or something like that. And that's been going since I've known Roger, which must be for 25 years probably, but we've shared the same message every year. We're not disappointed yet, have we?
There's
not
something.
The same Christmas card.
No, not yet. Roger, thank you ever so much for your time. It has been fantastic to talk to you, and I'm sure we're going to have to get you back, but thank you for giving us some of your time. You have to get back to writing now.
I will.
Anna Jane, email address
pllines@gmail.com. pllines@gmail.com.